We're talking with Dr. Alan Bodkin about his amazing work in induced after-death communication, some truly jaw-dropping stories and accounts that people have given him, people who are going through terrible grief, who suddenly find relief through this method and the experiences and encounters they have. We'll hear some of those tales right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Bodkin, I want to continue the conversation about why you think it works. What's process is going on? Is it some sort of a self-defense mechanism that humans have adopted? Or could it really be that they're having an actual encounter or some kind of a spiritual experience? I guess you have to kind of be careful in drawing too much of a conclusions.
Absolutely. And the only conclusions I stand by have to do with the fact that this procedure is very healing. You know, I should probably say something a little bit about EMDR.
Sure.
And IADC has derived from that, you know, with the changes I made. But there have been a lot of neuroimaging studies of this EMDR. And by the way, it's not just eye movements. It's any kind of bilateral stimulation. When people work with little kids, they put their hand on the table and the back of their hands are alternately tapped. Or some people wear headphones and get alternate sounds, you know, left, right in the ears. So it's any kind of bilateral stimulation. But given that this has been so obviously clinically powerful, there's been a lot of neuroscience research done on it. And what we have found is that when people access a trauma prior to EMDR, certain parts of the brain fire in isolation. And particularly those that represent the sensory and emotional components of a memory, which is why people feel like they're reliving the trauma all over again. And the frontal lobes, the thalamus, that sends information to all parts of the brain, those parts are shut down. What the eye movement does is it integrates information. It's a very natural healing mechanism. And it simply gets all parts of the brain working again, and the brain heals itself. When we're asleep and dreaming, our brains are actually processing and integrating information more rapidly and efficiently than when we're awake. And it's been known for some time that this increased processing during dreaming causes our eyes to dart back and forth, which is why dream sleep is called rapid eye movement or REM sleep. The discovery of EMDR seems to suggest that you can take a fully awake person, and if you can get her to move her eyes in a similar fashion, it actually puts the brain into that higher processing mode, and we can use it while people are wide awake. So by targeting the sadness in IADC, and we can bring that way down, that then opens people for this ADC experience. And I think the reason for that is this. Sadness simply prevents the ADC from occurring. Even people who report spontaneous ADCs, and I've talked to many hundreds of those people, they all say the same thing, which is they don't experience the ADC when they're feeling real sad or wanting some kind of connection. They always seem to just come out of the blue. People might be fast asleep, but they describe those experiences as very different from dreams. There's a clarity that dreams don't have, and an emotional impact that dreams don't have. Or people can be awake and, you know, taking their socks off and going to bed or brushing their teeth, and boom, there's the ADC. So what we do in IADC is we remove the block to the experience by processing the sadness.
That's are there cases where people have these encounters, tell you about their experience, and they convey information to you that they would not have otherwise, that is confirmable, something that they're told over there that they shouldn't know?
You know, I have a couple of responses to that. Sometimes people seek information that will help with the legal case that's ongoing surrounding that person's death. And it's interesting that I haven't done a lot of these, but a handful of these cases, the deceased are experienced as saying, you know, give it up. Don't worry about it. You know, you don't want to know. Just and because the deceased always come across as very, their only interest is in the well-being of their survivors. And sometimes pursuing things on a legal basis gets just people more embroiled in their own grief and anger and so on. But on the other hand, yes, sometimes things happen that people were not aware of, and we were later able to verify. For example, I was working with a Vietnam vet, and he was having an ADC with a good friend he had lost. And in his ADC experience, another guy showed up who he knew from the past and had something to say. Well, when my vet opened his eyes, he said, you know, what's so-and-so doing there? He's not dead. He's still alive. Well, anyway, over the next day, that vet went and researched it and found out that the guy who showed up had indeed died.
You say that you have a section where patients receive unwanted messages, which is kind of an important theme in the book. You had a case, a guy named Bill, and the title, just to jog your memory, is Forgive Mom, It Wasn't Her Fault, and You Should Get Back Together. Bill's son had been shot to death, gang-related activity. Can you remember that one?
Yeah. Bill, and his wife, their son had died, and Bill kind of blamed his wife for being too lax with him. And so the marriage broke apart because of that. And Bill was having an ADC experience with his mom, and his mom was telling him, forgive your wife. It wasn't her fault. You two need to get back together again. And when Bill told me what his mother had said, he then told me, I'm not going to do that. Yeah, I have no interest in getting back together with my wife. So, yeah, sometimes people don't agree with the advice they're given. Sometimes they don't understand it. My favorite case is a man was talking to his father, and his father was giving him, his deceased father was giving him fatherly advice, and his father told him to use his tools. So my patient opened his eyes and said, my father told me to use my tools. That doesn't make any sense to me, because my tools, you know, are 30 years out of date. They're sitting in the back of my garage, rusting out. They probably don't even work anymore. Why would he tell me to use my tools? So anyway, I took him back to the experience, and this time his father said, not those tools, the tools you're learning in therapy. And he's like, oh, those tools.
I thought it was kind of amusing. You had personalities kind of come through. They get chided by loved ones at things that the loved ones would know about them. Only they would know.
Yeah.
You had a case, Jared's case. You're late again. You're always showing up late.
Oh, you know, I don't remember that one well.
All right.
Sorry.
Well, there was I'll read a little bit of it. Greg Bermoldi, one of the psychotherapists I trained, was treating Jared for post-traumatic stress disorder resulting from a tour in Vietnam. One of the intrusive memories resulted from the deaths of most of his men in a unit in a firefight. And Jared, I guess Jared is getting chided by his mom for always being late. That kind of a message you get from parents who are deceased parents who are telling people things that they don't want to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? According to these ADC experiences, when people die, they don't change much. I remember one man I worked with who had induced after-death communications with me. He also had a spontaneous after-death communication, you know, before he came into therapy. It was years prior, and he woke up in the middle of his night, in the night, and his wife, who he had divorced from, was talking to him about everything he needed to do with the kids, and you know, you need to do this for Tommy, this for Billy, this for Sally, blah 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 blah. And she just went on and on, giving him all these instructions, and he didn't know why he was getting these messages. And the next morning, when he woke up, he got a phone call. and he found out that indeed his wife had died the day before. So, and I remember him telling me, he says, you know, she was always real talkative and bossy. Boy, she sure hasn't changed much.
You've had a couple of cases where living people appear in these things, not just other dead people that they don't expect to encounter, but people who are still alive?
That is extremely rare. If you can jog my memory on that.
There was
one.
A case, Jeff's case. Jason told me I shouldn't feel bad about his medical condition because it allows him to experience the best of both worlds.
Oh, that's a beautiful case. It's true that in ADCs, the elderly and the sickly, when they're experienced in the ADC, are always younger and healthier. Those with disability, like I talked about Gary's case earlier, the daughter who was severely disabled, in the ADC, though, they're completely free of those disabilities. So anyway, I was working with one guy, and he had a number of IADC experiences on some pretty serious losses. And he came up and asked me one day, he said he had a severely disabled son at home who had microcephalus. I'm probably mispronouncing that. But anyways, he was severely compromised and never learned to talk and so on. But anyway, he asked if he could do an ADC with his son. Would that be possible? And I didn't know, but I was willing to give it a try. And then it worked. And in the ADC, his son appears to him completely free of his disabilities and able to talk for the first time. And his son told him in the ADC, said, you know, don't feel bad for me. I really have it the best because I get to live in both worlds at the same time.
Reminding our listeners again, ADC, after-death communication, and the process Dr. Botkin has worked out is an induced after-death communication, an induced ADC. I thought one of the more interesting cases that is mentioned in the book is a shared IADC where images appeared to a psychologist who was sitting in and who was being trained. Do you remember the details on that one?
Yes, I do. He wasn't a psychologist yet. He was doing his internship before getting his PhD. And he had already learned how to do IADC and was actually pretty good at it. But anyway, I was working with a patient one morning, and my intern asked if he could sit in and observe. He had nothing else to do at the time, and it was fine with the patient. It was fine with me. So he was sitting over to our side, and while I was working with the patient. And for some reason, my intern closed his eyes and was giving himself eye movement. I think it was, if I remember right, he was doing it just to help himself relax. And a very strange thing happened was that a very clear series of images came to my intern. And when I had finished inducing my patient and he told me what had happened, my intern was sitting over there and was like, oh, my God, I saw the exact same thing. And then they compared, you know, notes and different details of the image that had come to both of them, and they matched exactly. Another psychologist on the unit, she had a habit of when the patient was having an ADC experience, she would give herself eye movement by just simply moving her eyes left to right. And she was able, in most cases, to observe the patient's private ADC experience. Now, these shared ADC experiences are very similar to probably in, the way it works to Raymond Moody talks about shared near-death experiences.
Right.
Where people on their deathbed, when they pass, people in the room sometimes are able to experience what the dying patient is experiencing.
Yeah, go along for the ride, so to speak.
Yeah.
Let's talk about skeptics a little bit. I did a sort of a survey online of how some of the hardcore skeptics mm-hmm. view this, and it's harsh. Their take on it is harsh, and what I find that they have to do is they have to overlook your results. they go into your motives a whole heck of a lot. You must be some quasi-spiritual guy. You're trying to foist the new religious beliefs on us. You're not a scientist without acknowledging the results.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they're not even listening to what I'm saying. And in fact, I don't claim. They're accusing me of things I don't claim. Now, I'm only aware of two of those, but both those critics are on skeptic websites. These people are firmly committed to their skepticism, all right? And so they're already locked into a belief system. My professional colleagues have actually been extremely supportive, and we are all, good scientist has a healthy degree of skepticism, but our minds aren't made up. It's, science is all about following the evidence wherever it leads us, and I think that's what a good scientist does. These people who are diehard fundamentalist skeptics have their minds made up.
Well, the fact that it might have some spiritual connection, it terrifies them, and they don't want any kind of hint that something like that might work. And I'm not saying that it is spiritual at all. I'm just saying that their reaction to it is so over the top negative without looking at the results. It just seems like the bottom line question is, does it work?
Right. Absolutely. And that's the only argument I really want to make. It works. It heals people to a degree that has not been even thought to be possible. I remember reading a website a couple years ago, a different one, and I won't even mention the name. The guy doesn't deserve it. But there was some discussion about IADC, and somebody said, well, this Dr. Botkin, he doesn't claim that his procedure or these experiences prove that there's an afterlife. He remains neutral on that subject, but it certainly smells like woo-woo.
Yes, I saw that one. Woo-woo.
Yeah, it smells like woo-woo.
Tell me this. Does
they've
suicide...
They've got their woo-woo sniffers out, most of them.
Oh, their antenna are always attuned for that. Some of your patients before this came along must have committed suicide. You must have lost some of them to suicide. Their grief was so intense. Does suicide play a role in this? Does it make it harder for people to get over their grief? Or is it does this technique, after-death communication, really specifically and specially help people like that?
People who have lost, people who have suicided?
Right, yes.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, in those situations, IADC is even more important because generally the survivors are just overwhelmed with guilt. They should have seen this coming. They should have been able to stop it in some kind of way and so on and so forth. And plus, the way these ADCs are reported is that the deceased are always very concerned about the pain and suffering they left their survivors in. So generally in those cases, I remember one where I think a young teenage girl, I think, had committed suicide, and I was working with her parents, and the girl came through in the ADC and said something like, it's really not your fault. It had to do with another relationship I had in my life, and I thought I understood love. I really didn't. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me.
And some of them, I would imagine, I think I remember from the book that they get admonitions from their loved ones that they should not commit suicide themselves.
Absolutely. The message is always hang in there, do your best. Yeah, don't commit suicide. Suicide comes at a cost. Of course, people who suicide aren't seen burning in hell or anything silly like that, but they are left with the issue on the other side of the pain they caused in other people. And that makes suicide not a good option.
Alan Botkin is my guest. We'll hear some more cases of induced after-death communication, then open up the phone lines with your questions right after this on Coast to Coast. We're talking with Dr. Alan Botkin about induced after-death communication, ADCs, and some pretty amazing experiences reported by his patients. But it's not only patients, it's professional people as well. When we come back, we'll hear a couple of those tales, plus some stories about pets that show up in these encounters, whatever they may be. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Botkin, not to beat a dead horse about these the skeptic folks, but there was one criticism online. They couldn't go after you for saying that this is spiritual or proof of afterlife or proof that heaven exists. So they went after the guy who worked with you on the book, Craig Hogan. They found that somewhere he had written that he believed that. And you respond in the book saying, "I feel the metaphysical speculations should not create prejudices either against this therapy or for it. It works dramatically, so it's worthy of study and common application in therapy. You shouldn't be shunned because it inspires metaphysical speculation." Going after the guy who co-wrote the book and what he might believe in his heart is, it seemed to me, out of bounds.
Craig Hogan did a great job helping me write that book, but he is not a mental health professional. He has a PhD, but it's in writing, and he's a good writer, you know, people are free to believe whatever they want to believe, but it doesn't fit my life's mission. I mean, Craig and I have very different perspectives on the whole thing.
You mentioned in the book that there are other mental health professionals who have been through this, who've had the experience. Do you remember any specifics?
Oh, boy.
It's been a long time, I know.
You know, I've done thousands of these at this point. Yeah, I mean, mental health professionals, physicians, scientists. In fact, I remember working with a guy who came in who was very skeptical, and he was a well-known PhD, a theoretical physicist. And he came in a little skeptical, and he had lost a son, and he had a beautiful ADC experience with his own son. And what was interesting about that case, I'll never forget it, is in the middle of giving him eye movement, he experienced his own life review in the session. It was really one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen. But when I worked at the VA and I had a number of colleagues and we were all doing IADC, you know, we did the procedure on each other as well. And, the results were identical to those, non-professionals. I mean, there's really no difference whatsoever.
There's a case you have in the book. You use the name Joe. Joe is a psychologist. He knew that spontaneous ADC experiences resulting healing emotional wounds. He was skeptical about it. He wanted to try it for himself. And he began, I guess, telling you about his father. Well, he had a good relationship, but the father had died. Even though he had a positive relationship with the father, they had unfinished business. Do you remember this? He did another induction. I can see a small bright light. It's getting larger and larger. Vague image of his father's face floating out of this light. Well, yeah. If you don't remember, that's okay.
Well, no, I do remember. I do remember the part that I thought was most significant, which was one of the main difficulties that Joe had with his father's death is that his father feared dying so much, and he right up to the moment he died, the father was just terrified of dying. And that kind of freaked out Joe, that his father went that way. And I forget the exact details, but in the ADC, seeing his father being very comfortable and at peace with the whole thing regarding his death gave Joe exactly what he needed. And I remember Joe saying afterwards, he said, "That's exactly what I needed, but I didn't know that that's what I needed."
There was one case in the book that And I was wondering whether people ever have encounters with famous people who are dead. And there's one case where one of your guys, one of your patients had an encounter with Martin Luther King Jr. And
Oh,
I thought,
yeah.
well, that's got to be wishful thinking that you run into Jesus or Abraham Lincoln or something like that. But it turns out that there was a special reason why maybe MLK would show up in his
Yes.
experience.
And there definitely was. If I remember right, my patient, when he was a little boy, was in Memphis when Martin Luther King was shot. He was in the crowd.
Yeah, he had traveled there to see him that day and then didn't. He got sort of trampled in the crowd.
You know, there was a lot of chaos, and he, as a little boy, was traumatized by the whole thing. And, you know, especially the idea that his hero, Martin Luther King, had been killed, and his father's hero, and so on. And in the ADC, Martin Luther King came to him. And it was very healing for him to see Martin Luther King at peace and happy and so on. And Martin Luther King, I remember, even gave him a message, which was something like, there is still prejudice in the world today, but we have come a long way, and it's not as bad as it used to be, or something like that. But it was more of an uplifting, more optimistic kind of message. Of course, you know, the trauma was, as he was stuck in the middle of you know, with his hero being killed, and, you know, he couldn't move on from that, and he had a lot of anger the rest of his life, that he used to cover up that sadness from that day, and that traumatic sadness, actually. But
it's as if you get what you need.
Absolutely. Every ADC is people do get exactly what they need, even though both I and the patient don't anticipate what that is, you know, prior to the experience. But these ADC experiences are so directly targeted. They give people exactly what they need, just like the case of Joe, who we just talked about. You know, his father showed him and gave him something that he didn't know that he needed that, but it was exactly what he needed.
Why is it not hallucination? How do you rule that out? I thought you made some pretty good points in the book about why that doesn't work as an explanation for at least a lot of them.
Well, for one thing, hallucinations are generally a sign of some serious mental illness. Hallucinations vary extremely in content across people and have a lot to do with their own psychological issues that get expressed in the hallucination. ADCs, and as well as NDEs and deathbed visions and so on, are all consistent. The message is all the same. The content is the same. You know, people go through a tunnel to the light. Their loved ones look younger and healthier. They're surrounded by beautiful and radiant landscapes. You know, hallucinations generally aren't positive. They're negative. They're frightening. You know, people receive negative messages. You know, hurt yourself, go hurt somebody else, that kind. And so, you know, ADCs are uniformly positive. And the content is consistent.
And there's actual wisdom in this stuff. It's not crazy, fragmented thinking. It's some wise and smart stuff.
Absolutely.
What about outside scrutiny? We touched on this very briefly in the first segment, whether or not that's one of the criticisms. And I don't want to dwell on it too much, but, you know, you don't use real names here, even of the psychologists who have had these experiences. It's difficult for somebody outside to look in on it and say, this is real. So what kind of outside scrutiny has there been? And how much did they get access to?
Well, you know, as a psychologist, I need to maintain strict confidentiality for
sure.
All of my cases. You know, the only way to address, you know, outside scrutiny and questions about the validity of what's going on is, is to publish research and use, you know, and use numbers and statistical analyses that take a look at, you know, pre and post and follow up and what dimensions people get better on and so forth.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning of some sort of a survey, some sort of a review. I don't remember the title you gave it, but that somebody had taken a look at it and sort of verified that there were positive results for X percentage of the patients.
Yeah. I've had two studies recently published, and one was a formal analysis of 71 of my cases, and another study that was published was after I had trained a number of other therapists in the IADC procedure. I did a survey with them and asked them a number of questions about the kind of psychotherapeutic outcomes they were getting as a result of using IADC. And the good news was, and which I reported, was that people I trained do just as well as I do.
I got a smile from a couple of the cases that have pets involved in the visions. Yeah. or the encounters, whatever they are, where pets show up. Are not always the pets of the people who are dead, I guess, but sometimes that's the case. Tell me, can you remember any of those?
I kind of do have a favorite that sticks in my mind. I was working with a man who had lost an uncle who was a father figure to him. And he went through the IADC procedure, and in the ADC, his uncle was standing there talking to him. But the uncle also was holding on to the family dog, who my patient was very close to, and the dog had died years ago as well. And my patient had a nice ADC with his uncle, and everything seemed to be done. The next morning, he came in to see me, and he said he felt like there was something jumping on him all night, and it was kind of freaking him out. Well, I kind of had an idea what that might be. I didn't tell him, but we went back and did another session, and it was the family dog that was jumping on my patient throughout the night and trying to lick him and so on. So in the ADC, this time he played with the dog. And his dog was, you know, jumping and licking his face and all that. And then he told the dog to sit. And so then the dog sat. And that was the end of it. And he didn't have that sensation of being jumped on it anymore after that.
And the stories that are told about where these people are, where our loved ones are, I mean, it sounds a heck of a lot like our visions of heaven.
Yes, it does sound like that in many ways. Of course, there's certainly not, you know, harps and, you know, you're not going to sit on a cloud playing a harp, that kind of thing.
That kind of heaven, right?
Yeah, but people describe the other side as very earth-like, but more beautiful than earth. Oftentimes people are in beautiful gardens, you know, beautiful landscaped areas, and people say that the plants themselves seem to radiate their own inner light. One guy said he was in a strawberry patch, and he goes, "This is weird." He said the strawberries were about the size of a cantaloupe, and it was the deepest, richest color red that I have ever seen. There's no red like that on Earth. And I've had other people say of the lush landscapes and so on, things like, it was the greenest green I've ever seen.
Hmm.
So it's gorgeous. It's beautiful over there, according to my patient's reports.
But I don't know.
Very earth-like.
Doesn't sound, I mean, it sounds heavenly and peaceful, but it doesn't sound all that interesting. Well, that was just what do the people do all day? They run around in fields, and that was just an off-the-cuff kind of a remark. I saw an experience that a reporter had, somebody who wanted to write about this, a reporter named Julia Mossbridge. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
You remember that encounter? I guess she had a friend who died in college. She sort of blamed herself, and she figured, well, I want to write about this anyway, see if it's real. So she came to see you.
Yeah, because she had invited this boy This was many years ago. She had invited this guy to, to drive and come and see her where she was living, and he was killed on the highway on his way there. And so she felt guilt for, she blamed herself for him, his death. But in the ADC, of course, he said, it wasn't your fault, nothing to do with it. And her sadness was relieved to find that he was okay and so on. And there was a little dog there that, I forget the end of this, but there was a little dog with him in the ADC, and she didn't know he had a dog. But then she found out later through a phone call or something like that, that he indeed did have a dog, and it was the same breed that had that she saw in the ADC.
Right. What she writes in the article is, later I found out that Josh's sister's dog had died, and it was the same breed as the one I'd seen in my vision. I didn't know what was real. What I do know is that when I think of Josh, I no longer dwell on the images of me calling him or getting his car hit. Instead, I see Josh walking toward me, laughing and playing with an angel dog. That point about replacing the vision that we have, the last vision that we have, is a pretty important part of the getting over the grief process. You have other cases where horrible images, death mask images that people have of their loved ones.
Absolutely. Loved ones, so many situations in combat where, you find your buddy and his body is burnt to a crisp, or, they're broke, they're sliced in half, just awful, terrible, traumatic images. And what's interesting is after a person has an ADC and that person sees the deceased as whole and healthy and happy again, they have a hard time then bringing up the traumatic image. It's like the ADC image replaces the traumatic image.
Is it possible that, this is sort of a process of evolution? The human brain has evolved this way, so it's a mechanism for us to cope with grief, to somehow come to grips with our own mortality and be okay with it. Sort of like some people have tried to explain away near-death experiences. Oh, yeah, the light, that's because your brain is dying, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that? That maybe it is some natural evolutionary process that we all have that we just haven't figured out how it works yet?
Well, I'm not going to sit here and say that I know that that's not true. It's possible. If this is a positive hallucination that people have when they approach death, and or they get a positive response when, they've lost a loved one that replaces the negative response, maybe our brains did evolve that way. But again, it violates the principles of hallucination, given the consistency across all of these experiences. But, it's possible that we did evolve that way. And if it is a positive hallucination, it's the greatest hallucination of all time. And it would still be something that we could use to treat people therapeutically.
How long does it take to get into this state? If that's how it would be accurate to describe?
Well, I and most IADC therapists see people for two 90-minute sessions on back-to-back days. And sometimes people have an ADC at the end of the first 90-minute session, and maybe the other half have an ADC the next day.
Generally, do you need two for it to really work?
It's always safe. Smart and safe to have two experience or to have two sessions lined up, because you always want to make sure after that first session that everything's settled okay.
Are there people that it needs more, or they give up after two and it doesn't happen? They just quit, or they does it a well, third or fourth one work?
Generally, people. Those two 90-minute sessions are generally plenty of time for one traumatic loss. That's plenty of time. Matter of fact, sometimes we finish early. I do screen people over the phone, and to find my contact information, go to induced-adc.com. And all the information about the book and how to contact me and how to contact other trained therapists is on there. But I screen everybody. There are a few reasons why I wouldn't accept somebody. And all number right. one has to do with...
Let's get into that after the break. I'm interested in that, why somebody would not be suitable for this treatment. We're talking with Dr. Alan Bodkin.